You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, cosmologists claim that the universe was not born from a Big Bang, but from the collapse of a higher dimensional black hole.
You actually then trace back the history of that thing that comes out. It looks like it started from a Big Bang, but it wasn't really a Big Bang. It was just a star that collapsed to form a black hole.
The Dark Energy Survey launches and promises to reveal why the expansion of the cosmos is accelerating.
In quantum mechanics, even the vacuum has energy. You know, in that language, everywhere in the universe, there is an extra component, vacuum energy. Even my cup of tea has some dark energy in it.
Space-based quantum experiments could test the foundations of reality.
Performing experiments at such astronomical distances would bring in effects which it has not been necessary to consider to date.
And artists recreate particle physics at the bottom of a well.
When you descend into the well, it's like you've gone into another world. And the fact that you then, you know, encounter this, you know, what I think is quite a magical work, it just gives that other layer.
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster. Welcome to the new edition of the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. So I always say, a good place to start is at the beginning. In this case, the beginning of the universe.
You mean the Big Bang.
Nope. No, I don't.
Yes, you know, almost 14 billion years ago when the cosmos exploded out of a Big Bang singularity, a teeny tiny point with infinite density. It's so famous they even named a sitcom after it.
I know what you mean by the Big Bang, Brendan. I'm just saying that it may be an illusion.
What? No.
Maybe, just maybe. That's according to a trio of astrophysicists jointly based at the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo and at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada. They've been looking at the possibility that our universe, with its three dimensions of space and one of time, is actually floating through a higher dimensional reality.
Floating?
But pinned on a brain.
Brains.
That was a good zombie voice there, Brendan. Thank you. But not those kinds of brains.
Yes, I know that. I am a physicist, you know, not a biologist. You mean brains. B-R-A-N-E-S. As in membranes. I've heard this idea before. It's been around for a while. There's a bigger five-dimensional universe that has four spatial dimensions, one more than our universe, and a single time dimension. Within this higher dimensional bulk universe is a brain with three spatial dimensions. That's our universe. And all of us paltry three-dimensional people are stuck to this brain. We don't get to experience the extra spatial dimension, usually. What does all this have to do with the Big Bang?
So that's the new part. Niyaya Shafshordi and his colleagues proposed that if there was a 5D star in the bulk universe...
A 5D star. Okay, four spatial dimensions, one time. I'm with you.
And the star exploded, just as stars in our universe do.
Boom! Supernova.
Then, as part of it collapsed into a black hole...
A higher dimensional black hole.
It would eject out a brain, which would then house our universe.
Of course it would.
You nearly choked.
Of course it would.
Well, if I can't convince you, then maybe Afshordi can. He spoke with me earlier and explained why he and his colleagues are frustrated with the traditional Big Bang picture.
So there are a bunch of weird things about the Big Bang. And the weirdest thing is that how can you make a universe that is completely homogeneous and isotropic out of some violent explosion? Because, I mean, you usually think of an explosion as some chaotic thing. And how could this chaotic thing lead to something that's perfectly homogeneous?
As astrophysicist Niyayesh Afshordi notes there, it is difficult to explain how a violent Big Bang explosion led to a universe that looks homogeneous or similar in every direction. In particular, Astronomers have made detailed measurements of the cosmic microwave background radiation bath, which provides a temperature map of our universe in its infancy. It shows that no matter how far you look out across the sky, the universe was at an almost identical temperature. This is tough to make sense of, because not enough time has passed since the apparent birth of the universe, some 13.8 billion years ago, for the temperature to have evened out across such large distances. The standard explanation for the homogeneity of the universe is that the infant cosmos went through a rapid burst of faster-than-light inflation, stretching out a small homogeneous patch into our vast, uniform cosmos. But, Afshori argues, there are problems with the model of inflation, too.
But if you just look harder at this inflation, you see that if you go back to the beginning of inflation, you have essentially all the same problems. I mean, why do you start with the same state with a homogeneous patch of the universe? Why should be a huge homogeneous patch that's uniform? So the critics of inflation basically say that all the problems that inflation was supposed to solve, it doesn't really.
Cosmologists also cannot explain what happened when the Big Bang singularity, the point of infinite energy and density, exploded outwards. They do not currently have a theory of physics that can describe singularities, or how and why the Big Bang happened in the first place.
Yeah, and then the other problem with early universe is that when basically the densities get very high, our theories of physics, quantum mechanics, and gravity, we don't really have a satisfactory understanding of how they work together. And it becomes necessary to have this understanding to have a description of Big Bang. So the problem with being next to singularities, having next to singularities, is that since you don't understand what's happening there, if you're affected, if you're in the causal future of a singularity, then you cannot really use your theory because it is an unknown piece, basically, which is what's happening. Are stuff coming out? Are dragons coming out of singularities? Are gorillas coming out of singularities? So these are all possibilities. All we know is that the theories fail. So everything can go. This is similar to this map making, like ancient map makers, that beyond the boundaries of their maps, there could be dragons and such. So these are the problems with the explosion. This explosion, you don't really understand its physics because it's in a regime that our understanding fails. And also, your best guess for what it should do doesn't really look like our universe, because your best guess is something very inhomogeneous and chaotic, but our universe is very homogeneous.
To try to explain the origin of the universe, Afshori and his colleagues, Raziapur Hassan and Robert Mann, who are all jointly affiliated with the University of Waterloo and the Perimeter Institute of Theoretical Physics in Ontario, Canada, revisited the idea that our universe may contain extra dimensions that we do not directly experience. This notion received a boost in 2000 when physicists suggested that our cosmos is confined to a membrane or brain floating through a higher, five-dimensional bulk universe.
So the new twist, as you know, that came about, I think, maybe 15 years ago, was that even if there are extra dimensions, they don't have to be tiny, as people originally envisaged. They could be big extra dimensions, but we're just kind of constrained to a surface, to a membrane. So then the question is, if we agree that we could live on these types of membranes, how many ways can you live on these membranes? Because we don't obviously see extra dimensions, right? So one way was that, okay, so these extra dimensions are small, but not very small, so maybe about a millimeter or so. So gravity sees it, but other things cannot see it. But the other possibility, which was in some sense even the most radical possibility, and that was by Diwali, Gebadadze, and Porati model, is that, no, these are huge dimensions, but our surface, our membrane, our universe has its own gravity. That just lives on the surface, on the membrane. And then the bulk, the higher dimensional space, has its own gravity. So we essentially have our own universe with four dimensions or three dimensions of the space and one dimension of time. It has its own matter and it has its own gravity. But there is this higher dimensional space in which we float as a different type of gravity, and it could have different type of matter as well.
The team realized that within the five-dimensional bulk universe, stars and black holes could form, just as they do in our universe, but with a remarkable difference. During the process of 5D black hole formation, a 4D brain could be ejected, and that brain could house our cosmos.
So we asked the question that if these things are real, then there could be real events that happen, and one of the possible events that could happen in the universe that has gravity and matter is to form black holes.
Right, so this is in the five dimensions.
That's right, in the five dimensions. Even if you have just pure gravity in the five dimensions, it's possible to form a black hole. So the question then is that, so what if that was the beginning of our universe? It wasn't a big bang, but rather it was formation of a black hole. So forming a black hole is a violent process. In the course of that action, something comes out of the black hole, which looks like our universe. If you actually then trace back the history of that thing that comes out, it looks like it started from a big bang, but it wasn't really a big bang. It was just a star that collapsed to form a black hole.
So now I'm trying to picture the five dimensions. So you've got a five-dimensional star, and you say that during its collapse, the 4D brain kind of emerges. But where is it emerging? Physically, where is it in the five dimensions, this 4D brain?
So this would be basically enshrouding the black hole. When you form astrophysical black holes in our real space, this is something that astronomers know a lot about. So you would think that everything would fall into a black hole, but if that was the case, you wouldn't see the supernova. But what happens is that the central part collapses into a black hole, but the whole star is a mess. So the outer part, because of the amount of radiation involved, is pushed out and becomes supernova. And you can form black holes, but in the process, a lot of things can be ejected. And basically, the proposal here is that our universe is one of the things that ejected in the process of forming this black hole.
In the team's model, our universe is pinned to a brain that surrounds the spherical 5D black hole. It does not do away with singularities entirely, but instead of having a naked singularity at the origin of our universe, the singularity is cloaked behind the 5D black hole's event horizon, the boundary beyond which even light cannot escape. A cloaked singularity is far less of a problem than a naked singularity.
So this is the nice thing about this theory, that there is a singularity hidden behind the horizon of the black hole. That's not going to affect anything that we can see. The same way that formation of black holes in our galaxy from core collapse supernovae doesn't really affect anything outside. The singularity that forms as this five-dimensional black hole forms, that doesn't affect us.
If our universe is floating in a 5D bulk universe, this could help explain why our cosmos is homogeneous and looks almost the same in every direction.
I mean, in some sense, this solves all the problems that inflation is supposed to solve as we go over the problem, because essentially the problem with Big Bang is that it starts universe at a finite time, and then it's hard to imagine how the universe would become homogeneous, because those times are microscopic times, and our universe is very big. And as I said, the problem is still persists for inflation, because you have to start inflation at some point, and if the universe is very inhomogeneous, inflation cannot start. But then if you look at this scenario, you have infinite amount of time, because you had a star or something that existed prior to what we think it was the Big Bang. So it had lots of times to become homogeneous, reach some sort of equilibrium, and then collapse into a black hole.
Although, you know, you sort of described how the explosion of the Big Bang would be very chaotic, and here you've got the collapse of your star, which is also very chaotic. So wouldn't you just cause the same problem again, where even though perhaps your 5D universe is very homogeneous, because you've got this violent process, you kind of mess it all up again?
Yeah, so that's a good question. The question we don't have an answer for. So now, through the collapse, there must be instabilities that develop. Now, the question is that would those instabilities be on larger scales or on smaller scales? Even though it sounds like formation of a black hole is violent, but it's not really that violent, because black holes are huge and the size of the horizon is really, it's a microscopic huge size. So from that point of view, actually formation of black hole is not necessarily violent. So there would be violent things happening on the scale of the star, but on a smaller scale, there's plenty of time for things to reach equilibrium.
But there is also a huge amount of observational support for the Big Bang picture. For a start, our universe is expanding outwards, which seems to suggest that, if you turn the clock back, in the past it was much, much smaller and more dense. The black hole picture can reproduce this effect, though, because the team's calculations show that the brain that is ejected out of the higher dimensional black hole would also be expanding outwards. Measuring this effect could have fooled us into thinking that the cosmos was born from a Big Bang singularity, but that may just be a mirage.
Yeah, so the thing is that we don't actually see the Big Bang. What we do see is we see our universe expanding, and then we extrapolate back in time, and we see that if everything is expanding the way that it is, if you scrabble it back in time, at some point everything must have been at the same point, and there would have been infinite density, infinite pressure. So that's the idea, is that this might be a Big Bang was the an artifact of this extrapolation. It might be just a mirage. I mean, actually, that's what a mirage is, right? You're trying to extrapolate things, and you think that must be there, but it's really a reflection of something else, right? So extrapolations don't always work, and this might be one of those situations.
Thank you to Niyaya Shafshorty for explaining the team's new model to Zia. Right, so basically, what he's saying is either our universe was pooped out of a black hole, or dragons were created during the Big Bang.
Yeah, I don't think he quite meant that, but sort of. If you visit the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you can find a link to the team's paper, and also a story that I wrote for this for Nature. For that article, I spoke with Giridhvali, one of the originators of the higher dimensional model a few years ago.
Was he convinced?
Oh, well, you'll have to read the article to find out, Brendan. But the bigger question is, are you convinced?
Well, it's a hard question, but it's worth mentioning that the model does deviate from measurements of the cosmic background radiation made by the Planck satellite by 4%, which doesn't sound like much, but is a significant difference. And if they can't bring the model in line with the observations, then it will be ruled out.
Ah, that's the beauty of cosmology these days. We can actually get data to test some of these wild ideas.
It is a nightmare for us theoreticians. I preferred it when we could just make up stuff, anything, and nobody could tell us we were wrong. Take dark energy, for instance, that mysterious entity that appears to be causing the universe to expand at an ever-increasing rate. Nobody knows what it is, where it came from, or why it's doing what it does. And I like it that way. Every good theoretical cosmologist has at least 6 theories for what dark energy might be. But now that could all be coming to an end.
Oh no!
Oh yes. In August, the Dark Energy Survey launched its 5-year mission to map the southern sky in an effort to reveal what's causing the growth of the cosmos to speed up. Reporter Karin Pikama caught up with 2 of the survey team members, Ofer Lahav and Peter Dole, at University College London, who explained to her just how they plan to do this.
The universe is expanding, as astronomers have long known. But until relatively recently, physicists assumed that this expansion would gradually slow down, as gravity from all the matter in the cosmos pulled it back inwards. In fact, by analyzing the equations of gravity that arise from Einstein's theory of general relativity, they even believed that it might slow down so much that eventually the universe could collapse in on itself. But in the late 1990s, astronomers discovered something highly unexpected. Instead of decelerating, the expansion is actually speeding up. For centuries, astronomers have focused on the light emitted by the objects in the universe. Objects, including ourselves, are made up of atomic matter, and we understand very precisely the properties of this visible matter. But unfortunately, the presence of such normal matter alone cannot explain the accelerating expansion of the universe. Filling this void is a lot of stuff that is actually invisible, dark matter and dark energy, which together form about 95% of the universe. While the gravity from dark matter tries to hold everything together, dark energy actually tries to push it all apart. Initially, dark matter was winning this battle, but the balance tipped about 9 billion years after the Big Bang, still some 5 billion years ago from now. The universe had expanded enough for dark energy to be able to start pulling dark matter apart, causing the expansion to accelerate. Despite the fact that dark energy alone makes up 75% of all energy in the universe, it remains an enigma. Since its initial discovery, astronomers from all over the world have been studying the phenomenon. One such project, which has been 10 years in the making, and which started scanning the sky in August, is the Dark Energy Survey. At University College London, I spoke with 2 scientists involved in the project, which spans 3 continents, Professor of Astronomy Ofer Lahav and Director of Instrumentation Peter Dole. Lahav explained to me how the initial discovery came about.
In the late 1990s, two separate teams looked at the distribution and light from objects called supernovae. These are objects that suddenly go very, very bright. And at a certain point, there's an explosion. And you can look at, say, the galaxy, and suddenly you see a luminous source there which outshines the galaxy. And it happens about once per 100 years per galaxy, more or less. It's a very rare event. But nevertheless, those two teams managed to collect a reasonable sample of those supernovae. Then they used them as standard candles. All the supernovae have exactly the same intrinsic luminosity. So then you can basically tell the distance to each of them just by comparing the intrinsic light to the light we actually observe on Earth. So by plotting the luminosity of the galaxies against their distance, they could tell that the universe is accelerating. So what happened is the two independent teams could not explain the data by having just matter. They needed another component. It turns out that so-called cosmological constant, which is, if you like, the more traditional name to what we call now more generally dark energy, seems to fit the data pretty well.
Do we know what this dark energy is made of?
Right, so there are two options here. It could be that it's actually a new ingredient, for example, in the form of vacuum energy. In quantum mechanics, even the vacuum has energy. You know, in that language, everywhere in the universe, there is an extra component, vacuum energy. Even my cup of tea has some dark energy in it. Another possibility is perhaps we should accept that there is another tweak to the standard model in the sense that the curvature of the universe is not fully described just by Einstein's simple equation. Although it has to be said, the cosmological constant was already in Einstein's equations. He introduced it in order to actually get a static universe.
And which of those do you think is most likely?
Well, that's a matter of intuition. I tend to think that if indeed of all the possible scenarios of dark energy, if indeed at the end it's going to be just this cosmological constant, probably it's most natural to associate it with vacuum energy. But why is it at that level? That's still a mystery. We should come with some underlying hypothesis.
In an attempt to capture the nature of dark energy, a large group of scientists spread out across the US, the UK, Spain, Brazil, Germany and Switzerland have spent the past 10 years setting up the Dark Energy Survey, or DESS for short. DESS's telescope has just started scouring the night sky from a mountaintop in Chile, taking highly detailed pictures of the universe, and will be collecting vast amounts of data in the coming 5 years. First, I asked Lahav what the aims are of the Dark Energy Survey.
The idea is to create a map of 300 million galaxies, and these galaxies are used in a number of ways. First, the distribution in space allows us to measure geometry, because the galaxy pattern is regular, actually, and it's got a particular feature which we refer to as a standard ruler. That's method number one. It's not a method of looking at the clusters in distribution, how many are there. And it turns out that's also sensitive to the geometry of the universe and to the evolution of the growth of structure. A third method, which is probably the most challenging from the point of view of instrumentation, is to look at the galaxy images. And they actually get, although intrinsically they're not perfect circles, they get even distorted further due to intervening matter between us and them. That's called gravitational lensing. The effect of distortion is about 1%, and we have to measure it to about 1% in order to tell dark energy properties at 1%. That's very challenging, but those three methods combined could be very powerful to tell us about geometry and growth of structure. In addition, the survey will also produce light curves of 4,000 supernovae, and then we can check what is causing the acceleration of the universe.
Could you tell me a little bit more, Peter, about what these instruments are and how they have improved?
Well, the instrument that we've built for the Dark Energy Survey is essentially a large camera called DCAM. It's large. The lenses involved are about a meter in size, and there's about five of those sort of size lenses in the system. And essentially it is an imaging camera. So it takes pictures. It takes pictures over a very wide field of view. And it needs its wide field of view because you want to do an all sky or a large part of the sky survey and also look very deep. It takes pictures in using five different filters. So you put in colour filters and take a picture in each filter. So you get a very large picture, and you can't do that with a single detector. So in fact, it's got 62 detectors, sort of in a sort of mosaic of detectors, to build up a big image in one shot.
So you are using still images to look at acceleration. How do you get from those still images to knowing how fast the universe is expanding?
Well, you can use the still images by essentially working out how far each object is away from us. I can do that by looking at the different colour of the galaxy, or different intensity of the colour of the galaxy in each filter. And essentially that will give you a redshift. And the redshift tells you essentially how fast the system is moving away. So it's by looking at those still images in different colours that you can actually work out its distance, and essentially its speed away from us.
And how do you analyse these data then? Is it just looking at the colours and in their intensity?
Well, there's a lot of actually data processing in the image. Once you've got it, it has to be cleaned up because there's a lot of imperfections due to things like cosmic rays, satellite trails. But essentially, once you've got that calibrated image, there's a couple of methods. One is looking at the amount of light from each object in each colour, but also looking actually at the shape of each object. So each object, and there's many thousands of galaxies in each image, looking at each one and actually measuring its distorted shape and calculating over the whole field what the general distortion is. And from that you can work out things like dark matter distribution and then on to dark energy.
Besides the Dark Energy Survey creating a beautiful 3D map of galaxies using these techniques that Dole has just been talking about, the scientists on the project are hoping to be able to explain the nature and source of dark energy much more precisely. Here's Lahav again.
If we accept the result from supernovae, the universe is accelerating, but what's causing this acceleration? So to do that, the two effects are geometry. Right, the way light travels in the universe depends on the geometry of the universe. At the same time, cosmic structure grows with time. Although the universe is expanding, locally, gravity wins and bits and pieces get attracted to each other. The level by which the structure evolves in the universe does depend on the contents of the universe. So, for example, in a universe without dark energy, the growth of structure would be of one kind. In a universe with dark energy, it would be different. And actually, by using those techniques and contrasting them with possible models, we should be able to tell which models are out or which ones are still viable. And we hope that in this way we'll come up with a clear statement as to what is the source of acceleration of the universe.
Will we notice the effects of dark energy in the size and shape of our own galaxy? Or, you know, is gravity still the dominant force that holds everything together?
The way we use dark energy in cosmology is within the framework of general relativity. But we can look at it at a more simple-minded Newtonian analogy that basically we all agree to Newton's inverse square law, that the force between two bodies, force like 1 over the distance squared between them. However, if dark energy exists in the form of a cosmological constant, there's, if you like, another force which is linear. It's the force is larger, the distance is larger. And this force is opposing the gravitational attraction. So you can think about dark energy as a repulsive force. So there's a competition between the attraction and the repulsion. So it could be, it's a simple exercise to show that, say, on the scale of the solar system or even a galaxy, the effect is tiny because the amount of dark energy is so small. However, as you go to larger scales, it becomes more significant. In fact, recently we asked the question, if we look at the system of Andromeda and the Milky Way, is that system affected by dark energy? And the answer is yes. It's actually quite a significant impact. For example, if you estimate the total mass of the local group, so-called local group, it's Andromeda, Milky Way, together, it turns out to be 13% higher if you assume there's also dark energy in the universe. So to me, this is a kind of an evidence that we can notice that even on small scales.
The Dark Energy Survey has only just started taking its highly detailed images of the universe, and several groups around the world are also trying similar approaches. The reason for all these efforts is that it is only by knowing what dark energy actually is and the true extent of its forces that we can start to uncover what future awaits our universe. And if the dark energy exists in the way scientists currently believe it does, this future does not currently sound exactly like the place we might hope to end up in.
If the current observations are correct, the universe will expand forever. Eventually, galaxies will disappear from sight. Well, they will fade away, but also they will disappear from sight because they will leave so-called our horizon. And without giving a very gloomy forecast for the future, Andromeda, our sister galaxy, and our own galaxy, Milky Way, will merge at some point. They're falling towards each other. They'll merge into one big galaxy. And this new galaxy will just be there in a rather dark universe, dark in the sense of no light. So that's the future. It's going to be a cold and dark place.
That was Ofer Lahav and Peter Dole speaking with Karine Pickema.
I shouldn't have been such a grouch about their plans to discover the source of dark energy. Now that I've heard about the instrumentation, it sounds like a great experimental project. You can learn a lot by listening to this podcast.
Well, Karine certainly learned a lot more than that. After the interview, they took her to see parts of the telescope and also the skeleton of the philosopher Jeremy Bentham that they keep down in the basement at UCL.
The skeleton of Jeremy Bentham? These podcast scripts are getting more and more ridiculous. Is this a joke or a pitch for a horror movie?
Neither. It's true. On the podcast page,
www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
I'm going to put a link to a picture of Bentham's skeleton. He's been dressed up and he's wearing a wax head too.
That's like psycho.
You'll also find more information about the Dark Energy Survey too.
Who cares? Let's talk more about the skeleton. And the dragons that flew out of the Big Bang.
And the brain-eating zombies.
Brains.
This is all getting a bit scary.
In space, did you know nobody can hear you scream?
Well, okay, first of all, Brendan, I guess it's good that we're not in space. And second, what's this noise then?
Aha, that's the Nazgul, the Ringwraiths from The Lord of the Rings.
Close, but not quite. It's actually the sound of interstellar space, captured by the plasma wave instrument on NASA's Voyager 1 spacecraft.
Ah yes, because NASA recently announced that Voyager 1 finally left the solar system in August last year. Again. Maybe.
The soundtrack you heard reproduces the amplitude and frequency of the vibrations of dense interstellar plasma, or ionized gas. This helped NASA scientists to deduce that Voyager 1 first encountered interstellar space in August 2012.
Where it is now fighting the Nazgul.
This is going to be a long podcast, I can tell. Let's move on to the next item. China plans to launch a satellite in 2016 dedicated to quantum experiments that could help reveal...
Nazgul.
No.
Dragons.
No.
Space zombies that eat brains.
Really? Stop now.
Jeremy Bentham's skeleton.
Jeremy Bentham's skeleton isn't even in space, Brendan. I told you, it's in a basement at University College London.
They could launch it into space.
That's so wrong.
More wrong than dressing it up and sticking a wax head on it and keeping it in a basement to scare reporters?
You make a good point. But back to the actual physics. As I said, in 2016, China plans to launch a quantum satellite. This should help them to set up a global quantum communications network. But it also provides physicists with a great new opportunity to test some fundamental aspects of reality. In particular, what happens when quantum mechanics meets general relativity in the sky? Physicist David Rideout at the University of California, San Diego, organized a meeting bringing together theoretical physicists to try to devise such space-based experiments. And he told reporter Colin Stewart what they came up with.
David Rideout works in the mathematics department at the University of California, San Diego. Last year, he led a paper, funded by FQXI, which proposed a series of satellite experiments that would push our understanding of quantum physics to unprecedented distance scales. Such work would also pave the way for quantum communication, considered by many to be the future of safely sharing information. I started by asking him what makes the prospect of quantum communication so exciting.
So quantum communication is useful in a number of ways. One of the most popular is that it allows for something called quantum key distribution, which is a protocol for secure communication. So imagine if Alice and Bob wanted to arrange to share a secret key. The key encodes the way to encrypt the message and also the way to decrypt the message. And the trick in secure communication is to somehow arrange for two parties to share the same key. Back in the olden days, this was done, for example, by sending a person with a briefcase and handcuff and put them on a plane, and they could travel and bring the key to the other party. But of course, this is not very efficient. And so what we'd like is some more effective way to communicate using the magic of quantum mechanics, if you like. Then a pair of parties can arrange to communicate a shared secret using a quantum communication channel.
And quantum communication is so secure because the physics involved means the communicators would automatically be alerted to the presence of an eavesdropper?
So one can set up an experiment in which a pair of entangled particles are generated and then sent to two parties, which are usually called Alice and Bob. And then Alice and Bob can make a series of measurements on these particles. And it turns out that if Alice and Bob both make the same sort of measurement, then they can predict with certainty what the result was for the other party. However, if there's a third person who is intercepting the communication, then they would be able to see the effect of this third party.
What's the underlying physics of entanglement?
So you can generate a photon by a laser, and then if you send this photon through a particular crystal, it can be the case that it splits into a pair of photons, one of which is oriented in one direction and the other which is oriented in the opposite direction. Each party then can make a measurement of the orientation of the photon.
The behavior of entangled photons can be strange. What's so odd about what goes on?
So if the two measurement apparatuses and the decisions process made at each apparatus are separated by a very large distance, then there should be no way that the measurements made by Alice should be able to affect the outcome that Bob measures. But nevertheless, the prediction of quantum mechanics is that the probabilities for the outcomes that Bob would measure depend on the direction of Alice's polarization analyzer.
And that strangeness has led some to point out a potential loophole in these experiments?
Currently the largest distance between Alice and Bob for this sort of experiment that's been achieved is something of the order of 100 kilometers. So the light travel time for hundreds of kilometers is much too brief for a actual human decision time, the human thought process. And so the decisions are made by random number generators. So there's some device which decides whether to measure in one basis or the other. But a potential loophole in these experiments is that one might imagine that since these are random number generators, which are based on mechanistic principles, that if there's some way that the outcome at Bob's analyzer could have somehow learned what measurement setting Alice used, then you could imagine that somehow the outcome then that Bob gets could depend in a causal way on the measurement setting that Alice used.
What could be done to try and close the loophole?
A proposal for a more robust test is to separate Alice and Bob such that one is on the moon and one is on Earth, so their distance is large enough that these decisions of which analyzer setting to use could be made not by some mechanistic device, but by an actual person.
Might such long-range tests reveal something about quantum theory currently hidden from us?
That's right. So this is a regime of quantum theory which has not been tested to date. So it's possible that we may see some deviation from the predictions of quantum theory at such large scales. Or maybe a more reasonable expectation is that performing experiments at such astronomical distances would bring in effects which it has not been necessary to consider to date. And so from a science perspective, one of the potential benefits of performing experiments of this sort is that it will encourage physicists to think more carefully about the implications of, for example, space-time curvature or various relativistic effects.
So that takes into trying to unify general relativity with quantum physics, which is one of the most sought-after prizes in all of physics. Is your work helping with that goal?
So one of the effects of just our paper, which is encouraging physicists to start thinking about how to approach the question of reconciling quantum theory with gravity, most of the effort to date has been in considering some very abstract ideas and working out the mathematical implications of these abstract ideas. But because there have not been experiments which really touch on some of these questions, the scientific progress has not been directed by experimental results. And so one of the scientific effects that we're seeing now is that our paper is inducing some new results in which physicists are really taking seriously the sorts of things we might learn from experiments and thinking a bit differently about how a reconciliation of gravity with quantum theory may play out. Potentially could have a significant impact on the development of theoretical physics. The advent of this technology, which will be brought about by quantum communication to satellites, could have effects on theoretical physics.
Thank you to David Rideout for speaking with Colin Stewart there. You can read a Q&A with Rideout on the website, www.fqxi.org/community, where he goes into much more detail about the sort of experiments that could be carried out on the satellite. Now, Brendan, can I tell you about the next segment, calmly, without any references to sci-fi, fantasy, or horror this time?
Okay, what is it?
It's a total change of mood. I recently visited an exhibition at the London Canal Museum developed by artist Lindahl Phelps in collaboration with particle physicist Ben Still of Queen Mary University of London. Phelps was asked to create something that depicts the ideas and methods of particle physics experiments. Taking inspiration from the underground Super Kamiokande Neutrino Observatory in Japan, where Still works, she built a huge installation housed in an ice well at the museum. Having descended down two ladders into the well to view the piece, I chatted with both Phelps and Still about what they hope the exhibit will achieve.
I really want people to feel that they've encountered something quite unique, and that's the combination of experiencing these spaces. And when you descend into the well, it's like you've gone into another world. You know, by the time you put your hard hat on, by the time you come down the two metal ladders, everything changes when you come down. The air is different. It's humid down here. The sounds are different. The smells are different. So you automatically feel that you've gone into another place. And the fact that you then, you know, encounter this, you know, what I think is quite a magical work, it just gives that other layer to it as well. So I just kind of hope people leave feeling that maybe they've entered another world for a while that they've really enjoyed.
That was artist Lindahl Phelps describing her installation, Covariance. It is the first part of the Superposition Project, initiated by the UK's Institute of Physics to bring together artists and physicists. Dominating an underground cavern at the London Canal Museum, the piece hangs like a giant chandelier from the ceiling. The installation was inspired by the Super Kamiokande neutrino detector in Japan and evokes aspects of particle physics experiments with its shape, colours and materials.
The work is basically made up of six concentric circles that are in a framework in the ceiling, and then 380 discs are suspended from that in drops of five. And within the six concentric circles, the outer one is made up of disks that have clear glass beads and diamantes on them. And the reason I've chosen them to be clear is they replicate exactly the clear glass domes on the side of Super Kambikandi. And also the concentric circle patterns that you get in the particle detectors are actually the designs that are on those outer disks.
Phelps created the work in collaboration with Ben Still, a particle physicist at Queen Mary University of London, who has worked at the Super Kamiokande detector. The design of the piece was based, in large part, on his descriptions of the methods used to collect, analyse and reconstruct the data in such experiments.
So you see a lot of concentric circles, but you also see regular grid-like patterns represented on each of the disks, but also in the piece as a whole. And this is mimicking the regular structure of particle detectors, which have to be irregular in structure, so that we can reconstruct exactly what is going on inside these massive machines. Because what the sensitive electronics usually tell us is how much light or how much energy is being deposited within these particle detectors, and then the very accurate placement of all these pieces can tell us the position, and we also have accurate timing, and from all of that we reconstruct the underlying physics. And the outer rim of clear beads are to represent these electronics I was talking about, light sensitive, that usually surround all of these particle detection mediums.
And then as you move in, then you get a series of coloured discs. The next area of concentric circle is blue, then it's green, then orange, and then two of red. And those colours have been chosen because they're the colours that Ben uses, but they're also generically used within particle physics to represent the activity of particles within the particle detector.
I mean, for instance, in a lot of event displays, we'll have a colour spectrum which dictates how much energy is being deposited. And we'll usually use, you know, red would be a high number or a high value of energy, whereas low in the blue would be a lower value of energy. And this is kind of represented in the piece with the red disks in the centre being a lot more densely packed and the blue disks being a lot less tightly packed. This is the way in which this piece is, you know, reflecting the different aspects of particle physics.
The materials used in the piece not only reflect aspects of particle physics detectors, but also reference the workers, in particular the female computers, as they were known, who historically recorded data from particle physics experiments, as Phelps explains.
In terms of the materials, the reason I've chosen the beads and the diamantes, which may not be your first choice for something connected to particle physics, but the most important part of them is that they react to light, and light is integral in terms of basically detecting particles, and that's how the information is relayed back to various computers and so forth. So I wanted a work where light very much was playing within the work. And then the other sort of reference to the materials is that one of the ways that Ben and I worked was that before we had a meeting, I would ask Ben to just email me some keywords or phrases that would be part of our next meeting. And I'd then feed those into Google Image and see what happened or what came up. And one day I just came across this very, I loved it, image from 1970 of a bubble chamber experiment in Atlantis. And essentially it was a woman sitting at a console, hair in this wonderful beehive hairdo. And I was just really curious, so I took that along and said, you know, Ben, what's this? And then he told me about the female computers who were employed to basically record all that data that was coming out of the bubble chamber photographs. And I was just instantly captivated because I've always been drawn to areas where there's a real strong sense of labour and work ethic, and particularly if it's a repetition of a simple task over and over again. So I kind of knew that the work that I wanted to make, I somehow wanted to represent those women and to make a work that required me to do simple tasks over and over again that was very repetitious and very tedious, which this was. And then the other link is that obviously glass beads and diamantes are a very feminine object, which again, you know, is that nice link back to the female computers. The other material that's quite important here is the brass, in that all the links are handmade from brass rods, and then all the beads are glued onto brass rods that go through the clear acrylic discs. And that comes from the history of science and scientific instruments. One of the sessions that Ben and I had was in the Science Museum. And besides looking at various things attached to physics, we were walking past the 18th century gallery. And I love historical scientific instruments, so we sort of veered into there. And at some point whilst we were there, I said to Ben, what in this room relates to what you do? Thinking really that the answer would be probably nothing, because there's so many, you know, hundreds of years in between them and what Ben does now. And he was quiet for a while, and then his answer was great. It was everything. So I was really keen to have something in the work that related back to those times of the early origins of science and scientific instruments, and brass was obviously the material to do that with.
And of course, the other thing to say about it, which you're too modest to say, is that it's absolutely stunning to look at. And part of that is the location. It's underground. It's in an ice well. I'm not exactly sure what an ice well is, but perhaps you can explain that to me. Now, I've seen pictures of this piece of work, I guess, as it was in development on the website, and it looked beautiful. But here in place, sort of in the dark with very subtle lighting, it just sort of takes on a completely different character. So can you talk a bit about how the actual location was chosen and what it's meant to represent?
The location was key. So once I learned more about particle detectors and the fact that they're all subterranean, that they're either under earth, under ice, or under water, then I knew instantly that I wanted to try and find a subterranean location in London where we could put the work. And I also wanted it to be a location that not many people have ever been into, that it was going to be quite a unique experience to get into it, which led us to the London Canal Museum. And it's become more and more perfect in a way.
The environment is reflecting the environments in which the detectors are usually placed. So a lot of these particle detectors have to go underground or underwater or indeed under ice to protect them from cosmic rays that are bombarding us all the time, so that we can make sure that what we're seeing is exactly the particle events that we're interested in, usually neutrinos. And so where we are right now, underground in these ice wells, so as you rightly said, they used to house ice in the Victorian age, which would then be sold throughout the year. And it was actually a business idea of an ice creamer. And he initially wanted to bring everything over so he could make tasty ice cream, but ended up selling the ice as well. So shipped from Norway, brought up the canal, and then dumped in here. These wells are actually full with a lot of dirt. They're actually 12 meters deep in reality. So there's a lot of dirt beneath our feet. They were filled in the 50s after London was cleared after the war. And so you've got the link to ice. As I mentioned, some detectors are under ice. You've got the link to underground because we are subterranean. But also you've got the link to water as well, with the canal nearby, and we're actually below the canal waterline. And so there are lots of links to where these detectors are actually housed. So it's a perfect location for such an installation.
So, you know, it just seemed to be the ideal location for that. The other is that it's circular.
Yes.
Its shape is basically replicating Super Kamikaze, which is in the process of building two new detectors that will be parallel to one another, exactly as these two wells are circular forms that are parallel to one another. And then there's another quite sort of slightly less obvious link, but I talked about the female computers and having an identity with their labour. And the more I've started to think about this building and the men who toiled down here, putting ice in the wells, moving it out, it would have been a really hard, physical, repetitive work. So there's a really nice link there with it as well.
You know, it's such a big piece of work. It's huge in scale. How long did it take you to put it together, and how difficult was it to kind of construct it in this location here?
Oh, that's a very good question. It took a long time, but a relatively long time to make. And it has taken 3 months, and that has been working every day without a day off, long hours to get it finished. And so, you know, it's been a huge labour of love to make, but it all comes apart in bits. It's really great. So even the framework that it's suspended from, when the engineering firm who made it brought it down, it was dropped down in bits, and then they assembled it down here. And then when all the discs came, they were all packed individually in boxes that I had snaffled from a local supermarket, of which there were 30 boxes in total. And the light boxes, obviously, they came in their own sort of packing. But everything was just dropped down the opening in the well by rope and assembled.
Well, like I say, it's an absolutely beautiful piece of work. You must be very, very proud. What do you hope people coming to see it will kind of take away from it?
In some ways, I hope they have the same journey that I had. This was my first foray into particle physics. And Ben knows, I've said to him that initially, whilst I was very excited to be involved, I was a little bit sort of nervous also about the particle physics area, because my perceptions of particle physics was that it was very abstract. My first meeting with Ben, really just all those things went out the window, because he talked a lot about Super Kamikaze in Japan, and one, it's just incredibly stunningly beautiful to look at, and I was, as soon as I saw it, I was just captivated, and the first thing I said was, well, can I get there? Can I go there? And the answer was no. So I knew from that moment that the seed of an idea for whatever the work would be, that it would be something, hopefully, that would have that same kind of visual impact to Super Kamikaze, but be a place where you could go and physically encounter it. And then he told me about the story behind the glass domes that line the walls of Super Kamikaze, and how they're hand blown in the mountains of Japan, where the air is pure, by men who don't smoke or drink, so their breath is pure. And that's just wonderfully poetic. So my preconceptions of sort of dryness and abstractness were completely, as I said, blown out of the water when, I began to realise that particle physics was very, visually rich and, even poetic. So it was just a wonderful discovery. So I'm really hoping that people will be, just their curiosity will be tweaked to go away and just find out more.
Thank you to Lyndall Phelps and Ben Still there. For those of you near London, there's still time to book a visit to see Covariance, and I've posted details on how to do that on the website. On October the 17th, there will also be an In Conversation event where Phelps and Still will be discussing the work. And if you can't get to London, then I've posted images of the exhibit on the website, www.fqxi.org/community.
So that was recorded down in the well. What did you think?
I actually, I wasn't sure what to expect when I was heading down there, but it's a very impressive piece. It's, for one thing, it's huge. It's very, very colourful. The day that I went there was a hot summer day in London, and, it's very noisy and bustly above ground. And then you climb down these two ladders into a very quiet, dark, cool, very contemplative space where they have hung this huge installation that really dominates the space. It certainly provokes thought.
Have you been to the actual Kamikaze or the detectors at CERN?
Yeah, I haven't been to the Japanese detector, but I have been to CERN, and, nothing can really recreate exactly what it feels like to go underground at a huge particle accelerator, because, they are so vast. Everywhere you look, you're in these gigantic tunnels, and there's just massive equipment all around you. But what it does capture is actually kind of the look of the particle detector. There's a lot of rotational symmetry. There are a lot of concentric circles in both real detectors and also in this piece. There's a lot of colour, and it does give you a sense of what those detectors actually do look like.
Well, it sounds like if I could, I should go.
Absolutely. I would say it's a very different experience, because I think you're climbing into the well. You get a real sense of, getting dirty quite literally and experiencing the piece of art. In a way, I guess that kind of captures the sense of doing science in a way. It's a bit more hands-on than many exhibits are, and it's well worth a look. There you see, Brendan, there was nothing frightening about that at all.
Right, apart from the bit where you descended into a well to see a Japanese-themed exhibit. Have you not seen the original Japanese version of The Ring? To any visitors, I would just say watch out for young girls with long wet hair covering their faces.
But if you do go and you're on Twitter, you can let us know what you thought at FQXI. You can also email us at podcast@fqxi.org.
That's all we have time for this week.
Thank you again to Niaya Shafshordi,
The Dragons and Zombies,
Ofer Lahav, Peter Doll, Corinne Pickema,
Jeremy Bentham Skeleton,
David Rideout, Colin Stewart,
Nazgul,
Ben Still and Lyndall Phelps,
and Sadako from the Japanese horror movie Ring.
No, don't thank her. Don't encourage her at all.
She's been Zia Morali.
And he's been Brendan Foster.
Oh, Halloween came a bit early for FQXI this year.